introductions, announcements. I think that must be you. We ready?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, and a lady in the back says she's going to beat me over the head if we aren't out of here by 7 o'clock. So, I'm a little scared. All right, so let's start up if we can. And Jessica, you're kind of matron of honor here.
Well, welcome, everyone. Thanks for coming out. Thanks for being flexible with the time. We had a meeting in here earlier in the day, so that's why the tables are a little different than usual, but we also hoped it might be a little roomier than fitting you all up there. So we don't have much in the way of announcements, okay. Unless you have anything, Pat?
No, I do not.
Then we ought to go to the approval of minutes from way back in August. 24. Everybody remember that as far back as it is? What we see there? Yes, sir.
Motion to approve.
Okay. Second. All in favor?
Aye.
All right. New committee meeting policy. You're going to have to fill us in there.
I will. So this is going to be, if there's a new meeting policy that's going in as an update to our bylaws. So CMAQ approved a set of bylaws in 2020. And then last year, 2024, some new laws were introduced with the Freedom of Information Act regarding virtual meetings and virtual participation in meetings. So the Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA, commonly called, describes rules for public meetings to be fully available to the public. For example, how we are required to advertise notices so everyone who wants to come can come. Three or more committee members discussing committee business constitutes a public meeting. So, for example, if three people are carpooling, three committee members are carpooling on the way to the meeting, and you're talking about, you know, crab prices or the football game, that's totally fine. But if you're discussing committee business, that's technically a public meeting and would require public notice and public access. So keep kind of the business discussions here. And with these new policies that I'm going to be going over, all committees must approve the policy before we can allow any virtual meetings or virtual participation. So, for example, with our FinFish Advisory Committee, last November, someone called and said, I'm having medical issues, I can't make it, can I participate virtually? And we had to say, unfortunately, at this meeting, we're going to be passing these policies, so we're not allowed to. It wouldn't be legal to include someone virtually. So these are the updates to the bylaws, which you all have a copy in your email, and I think we had copies distributed for you. So in Article 3, Membership Details, Section 6 on Quorums, says committee members participating remotely as per Article 6, which is the article we're adding to the bylaws, will only count toward a quorum if their physical attendance is prevented by a disability as defined in Code Section 51.5-40.1, or if they are a caregiver for a family member with such a disability. And all the language I'm going over is almost directly from the Freedom of Information Act. So this is the new section. With regards to remote participation, an individual committee member may participate from a remote location only if a quorum of the committee is physically assembled at the public meeting location, and there are arrangements for the voice of the remote participant to be heard by all persons at the primary meeting location. So reasons individual members can use remote participation is If the member has a temporary or permanent disability or other medical condition that prevents the member's physical attendance, a medical condition of a member of the committee member's family requires the member to provide care that prevents the member's physical attendance. The member's principal residence is more than 60 miles from the meeting location identified in the required notice for such meeting. You know, we're not going to make anyone from Tangier come all the way out here. The member is unable to attend the meeting due to a personal matter and identifies with specificity the nature of the personal matter. However, one member cannot use remote participation due to the unspecified personal matters more than 2 meetings per calendar year or 50% of the meetings. And there's no limit to the number of times a member can participate remotely for the other reasons, like medical or distance. This just says the meeting minutes will record where that person is participating from. So for all virtual meetings, which I don't think is anything this committee has done except during COVID, the meeting may convene a maximum of 2 all virtual public meetings per calendar year or up to 50% of the meetings held per calendar year. So for example, if we had 2 meetings per year, one could be virtual. However, the all-virtual meetings cannot be held consecutively with another all-virtual meeting. And then these are just conditions we have to follow in public access. When we're posting the agenda, we have to say if it's virtual or in person. Public access to all virtual public meetings will be provided via electronic communication means. The phone number of the chair or a designated staff member will be provided at the start of each meeting. So if something on our end fails, we can get in touch with you. If something on your end fails, you can get in touch with us. And if there is a problem with the meeting itself, the committee will take a recess until public access is restored. And no more than 2 members of the committee can be together in any one remote location unless that remote location is open to the public to physically access it. So does anyone have any questions on the new policy?
What was that last one?
No more than 2 members of the committee are together in any one remote location. So if we were to hold a remote location, 3 of you couldn't, you know, meet at someone's house to listen in unless, you know, we identified a remote library that was advertised to the public as they could join. Any questions?
So the committee members will be considered just like commission members. We could never be, you know,
3 or 4 at a time. Yeah. Get someone and talk things over.
Correct?
Yeah, correct.
Even if we'll be drinking beer?
As long as it's not committee business. And that doesn't mean smuggling beer into our meetings here. Okay. If no questions, I think we would need an agreement from the committee to amend the bylaws.
I'll make a motion to pass bylaws as presented.
Second.
All right. We've got a motion to approve and a second. All in favor? Say aye. Any no's? All right. Great.
Okay.
Okay. So we'll move on to the 4th item on the business, which is review new business, but starting out with the winter dredge, winter crab dredge survey.
And just with that last item, in the future, if we're having a meeting and I email you all, say when and where it is, and want to participate virtually for any of the reasons included in the policy, just let us know and we'll make sure we have access for you. So as soon as possible is best, just to work out any IT kinks. All right. So getting into the 2025 winter dredge survey abundance results, most abundance estimates decreased from 2024. So the total crab abundance decreased 25% to 238 million crabs. The adult female abundance decreased 19% to 108 million crabs, which is still above the abundance threshold. So the female adult females are not overfished, but are below the abundance target. Adult male abundance decreased 43% to 26 million, and juvenile abundance decreased 25% to 103 million. So we're getting to the graphs. You see every year, like I said, total abundance of crabs of all ages and sexes was 238 million. That's as opposed to the average on the orange line there of 401 million crabs. The adult abundance, ages 1 plus, was 138 million. Adult abundance by sex, the pink line are the females, the blue line are the males. So the adult females, there were 108 million, and the males were 26 million.
What was what now? The males and females were how many?
Females were 108, the males were 26. 26. So here's the adult female abundance according to the biological reference points. So that green line is the target we're aiming for of 196 million crabs. The threshold below which the population is depleted is 72 million. So the females are still in the okay range. And then here's juvenile abundance, which was 103 million this winter. And the average since 1990 was 203 million. So moving on to the Baywide commercial harvest. This is commercial harvest of blue crabs from Chesapeake Bay, which does exclude the seaside areas. The total harvest was 42.5 million.
And that's in pounds, correct?
Yes. So these graphs show the distribution of male and female, well, female and then male harvest amongst the jurisdictions, mostly Maryland and Virginia. So the bars are the total harvest by each jurisdiction, and then the line graph is what percent of the harvest came from each jurisdiction. And this year, for the first time, it was about 50-50 Maryland and Virginia for females. Meanwhile, males held at about the 70-30 split. That hasn't changed much over time. For the female exploitation rate, we're at 22%. So that was the percent of females present in the bay at the start of the year, which were subsequently harvested. I'm sorry, just a minute. I'm hearing someone buzzing. Can someone let them in?
You said this was the first year that Maryland and Virginia were both equal in the harvest of females?
In the range I've got there.
Right. What were other previous years to that? I mean, how did Maryland do compared to Virginia in the last 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years?
So from 2010 through 2017, Virginia was about 60-70% of the harvest. And then since 2018, it's been between 50-60%.
What was it prior to those years?
Virginia was probably closer to 70%.
We harvested 70% of the females, and Maryland harvested 30%.
Correct.
In the last few years, that's changed now to 50-50.
Since 2018, it's been probably It's been between 50% and 60% of Virginia, and then 40% to 50% Maryland. But this year is the year they were closest.
But it's been climbing.
No, the graphs right there, you can kind of see the two different ones.
So we kind of had a period where...
Well, I'm looking for percentages. It's hard to see that.
We kind of had a... we had a period where it was like this, 70-30, and then there was a period where it was like 55-45. So there hasn't been like a decreasing or increasing trend so much as there's a difference between that period and this period. So 22% of females were removed from Bay. That's below the female-specific target and well below the threshold over which we'd be considered overfishing. So we haven't had any overfishing since, looks like, 2007. And then there were a few years in that pre-2008 period. Male exploitation, we don't technically have biological reference points for the males. That's just with the not the way the stock assessment worked. But the managers set a conservation trigger of, I think it was the second highest exploitation rate historically. And so if we were consistently above that, it would kind of let managers know, let's take a look at this. So we had 2 years over in, I think it was 2021, 2022, but we're back down now. We were at 30% below, so below that 34%. So any questions on the dredge survey?
Do you have the weight total in males that were harvested last year, separated from females? So you had the total harvest was 43.5 million pounds. Do we have what males, what percentage of males or what that was?
I know I have it for sure on my computer, but it looks like Virginia had maybe 5 million pounds and Maryland maybe 27. Don't quote me on that. I can I can look that up and get back to you.
That'd be great if I could get it today.
I don't know about today, because I think it unless... Well, if anyone's on the VPN, Brooke, will you be able to show her where to find CBSAC results?
Any other questions? Mr. Duke?
I just don't understand why every time we come out with a bad survey, it doesn't really result in what we see in the... It's worked out nice, so I'll just tell people, look, I guess the price needs to go up, because it's in the world, but every single time it's like this, and they come out with this end of the world, it's bad, it doesn't translate into what you see people catching, and that's a bit of an issue, because, you would think if it was really true that there was not going to be trash, you'd have a lot more trouble.
Yeah.
So the when we looked at the data from the threat survey and we combined the 8-0s, the juveniles, and the large ones, you get a pretty strong correlation with the catch the following year. And so that seems to work well. And so what you're talking about is, recall that the females have seemed to be doing fairly well.
I don't know what age or class or stuff, how big is your female. I have no idea what,
around it.
One of the key issues that we've tried several times to try to get funding to go into the shallows, we know we're missing like between 70, 60, and 80% of the young juveniles.
And
we just haven't gotten the funding to be able to extend our survey to that. So that
I understand.
The reference points are saying that we're okay because we rely on the spawning stock, the age one plus females, because that's what eventually provides the juvenile, right, the offspring. And so there, we're neither overfished and we're not overfishing, either one of those.
I'm just saying,
so there's no, like, it's not like the sky is bomb.
I mean, because, like, for being where I'm at,
could the problem be the efficiency of the drench itself? And the reason I say that, I'm seeing a lot of mussels on the bridge funnel, which basically indicates to me that there's a lot of mussels on the bottom. And then also you have drift grass. If you drop your dredge in that drift grass, it's not going to catch. You know, mussels the same way. You're going to blow the grass out. Could that possibly be a problem? Are you seeing more? Are you seeing more stuff on the bottom this year than you have?
I would say not this year. I would say over the last 10 years, definitely. There's been a lot of grass, which is the high growers. That stuff's really increased a lot.
So the efficiency is going down.
We haven't seen it from our efficiency studies. Remember that our efficiency of our dredge gear is pretty low. It's like 20-30%, depending on which vessel you're talking about. So it's already fairly low. We can't conduct the widespread studies to look at the efficiency because we don't have the money to do that. We do have efficiency studies every year. We do that, and we don't see a big change in our efficiency right now where we conduct the studies.
When you were a crab dredging, if the grass was there, you wouldn't catch that crab. As soon as the grass would be gone, you would go there and let the dredging school. So if you go there when the grass is there, you're not even going to get back.
I got a follow-up. Also, I noticed on your picture that you have a smaller mesh bag, I guess, to catch juveniles. Have you ever taken that out just to see if your actual catch of female crabs, mature female crabs, increase or decrease by taking that small mesh out? Because it seems to me like the small mesh bag itself will cause a lot of back pressure and blow out a lot of other crabs. I mean, I could be totally wrong.
You're talking about adult females?
Yeah, I'm talking about adult females. I mean, have you ever done that, had a follow-up dredge in the same location?
So what we've done, we've had efficiencies in the same location, and we haven't seen a big change. And the one thing with the mesh...
Have you changed the dredge bag size to a conventional dredge bag?
No. Okay. We don't want to make changes like that to the survey.
But if you do that, at least you'll know, hey, guess what? Maybe we're blowing more adult female crabs out of the dredge compared to what you're doing, which would skew the numbers for the actual population of those females.
So presumably that comes out in our efficiency studies. So our efficiency studies tell us that we're catching only 20-30% or so of what's on the bottom.
Okay.
And so we use that to multiply.
And you increase your number when you run calculations.
Yeah, we typically divide the number by that fraction. Let's say 0.2, 0.3.
Right.
So it's multiplied up to account for that.
But I mean, so what I heard you say, though, is what Mr. Diggs described, you're not surprised with. The females are there, and that's what we mainly catch.
Yeah.
So you're confirming what he's saying should exist. So you're not disagreeing with each other.
No, I expected a pretty decent dealer run, for instance, each year, and that based on the female ones.
I have an answer for you.
They test 1,500 sites, right?
Sorry?
I said they test 1,500 sites with the drugs.
Yes.
Do you think that the dynamics of the craft fishery changed so much in the last 10 years? Don't you think that some of those locations, crabs aren't going there like they used to? I mean, we're seeing most of the big bulk of the crabs, you know, in deep water and in different locations than it used to be back in the crab dredging days.
We've seen kind of a shift of, at least in the main center of the bay, shift of the females down a little bit to a little bit lower in the bay than they used to, and that's in the last 10 years. But the survey itself, the reason we do 1,500 stations is because we know there are going to be lots of stations where you don't catch anything. But we can't, you know, we can't just say, okay, we're not going to go to those stations because that might be in 1 year, but next year there could be crabs there. So we try to keep that, and the reason we do 1,500, about 750 in Maryland, about 750 in Virginia, because some time ago we assessed statistically that that's going to give us a pretty good estimate of the whole population.
Another question. Out of the 750 sites, do you go to those sites when the water temperature is the same and also the same time of year? Or is it like, okay, I'm going to go to this site today, and next year you put it off until the end of the survey? Or are you consistent
with the
time that you start your survey? Are you consistent with that?
Mm-hmm.
And the locations. And then you take a reading of the water temperature.
Yep.
I know the water temperature varies, but you're seeing, when you go to that site, you're seeing a different water temperature possibly also.
Yeah, we're using that, and actually in the new stock assessment, we're using that information to try to adjust as necessary our indices, our estimates of abundance for that. We're using things like that, like temperature, because we know temperature has increased over the last 30 years.
I mean, this year I caught 5 4 stone crabs. Never saw them. 15 years ago I was catching.
Wait, sorry, you caught stone crabs again?
Four stone crabs.
Live?
I would say that's Virginia.
Do you have pictures?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I bought five.
I would love it if you sent those to me, by the way. We caught a stone crab probably about 5 6 years ago, live. But that was the last time we caught it.
I had 9 one day and 6 and 1 5.
Mr. Cox?
Stone crabs. I've seen stone crabs up to your forehead. The dredging. What's your speed that you drill, that you dredge, and how long do you go? We want to get back to the world we're talking about. The faster you tow, the more world you get. I'm wondering how far you tow and what speed and what distance. You got divers at that speed? You can tow 3 knots and no divers. Never come off the bottom.
They regulate the amount of chain that goes out.
Well, I understand all that, but that's pretty fast for no divers. 8 footer, 7.
Damn.
Okay. But stone crabs years back, they were unbelievable. I've had judges forward to pitch all the way back overboard again. Oh, crab pot. I filled a basket up 1 pot for stone crabs.
Next spring, you're going to find so many stone crabs dumped on your door.
Any other questions?
Just the clause,
Nathan? That male harvest, 16 million from Maryland, 5 million from Virginia, and 2 million from the PRFC.
Pretty impressive on PRFC, considering it's only one river.
How much from the total?
2 million.
So a total of 23 million pounds, 23 million pounds of male harvest, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, all right, thank you.
I'm sending out a million crabs. What happened?
You mean you talk about
why is it down? Why is it down so much? What's your explanation for that? What are you blaming
on?
Which
one are you talking about?
Why is it down so much? The amount of crabs were down in your survey.
Well, the females are not. That's just the young juveniles.
So what's your explanation?
And so
I'm hoping you're going to say water temperature because I'm going to eat you up. Go ahead.
No, I'm not going to say water temperature except that unless more of them are in the shallows and we're missing more or whatever. But I will tell you, this has bothered me for the last 3 to 4 years, and we're looking at that. We're trying to figure out exactly what's going on. We're looking at different tributaries, different locations in the bay with our data to try to figure out what is going on with that. Unfortunately, to be able to answer it, we would need to get like a big chunk of funding to have a separate group going into the shallows. We did that. We did that back in the 2011 stock assessment. That's where we actually got data when we went out in privateers and went into the shallows, went into seagrass beds, we went everywhere, coves, and that's when we got an estimate that we were missing 80% of the 8-0, the young juveniles, because they're in the shallows and our dredge boat just cannot go in there. But we can't, we don't have the funding to do that every year. So what the stock assessment does is it makes an assumption about what fraction we're missing, and then usually we add that back on.
What did you do? You hire contractors with smaller dredges and smaller boats?
No, we went out. We built smaller dredges and then went out in privateers, 23-foot, 21-foot boats. We actually went out and did the dredging ourselves.
And Ron, would you tell the audience and remind us, what is an age zero? I see that some of our terminology.
It's less than a couple inches in width. So what we usually say is 60 millimeters, and that's just over a couple inches.
And what do you call that, age zero?
Age zero.
Those are the ones that just came in.
Yeah, so 2 inches and less.
A little more than 2 inches. Yeah,
so 2 and a quarter.
Two and a quarter.
Ron, it says here, Virginia blue crab managers are not surprised by these findings, as cooler than average temperatures during the winter of 2024 to 25, which range from 2 to 4 degrees below normal, typically increases mortality rate of crabs that overwinter in the bay. Who is Virginia's blue crab managers? They came up with this 2 to 4 degrees was typically mortality rate. Who came up with that?
Well, I'm not sure about the temperatures.
That's what it says right here. It ranged from 2 to 4 degrees below normal.
Well, I was going to say, I know that we did see an increase in the overwintering mortality this year.
Was it because of the 2 to 4 degrees below normal water temperatures? That's what this says here.
Typically, when we have colder water temperatures, we have higher mortality.
Okay. Got a question. Who here crab dredged 50 years ago? Raise your hand. 50 years ago, crab dredge. 50 years ago.
I did 30.
50 years ago.
That would be you.
I did. I dredged with Captain Johnny Ward. I dredged with Captain Homer Elliott. Homer Elliott was one of the original crab dredgers. Heard all kinds of stories when I was a young man from him. Now, it was in the 70s, sometime in the 70s, the whole damn bay froze over.
78.
And prior to that, 40, 50 years ago over home, there wasn't a Coast Guard base at the time, but it had old wooden mast boats, it had an old round stern. There were a lot of days we couldn't get out because we were froze up. The Coast Guard built a Coast Guard station there. They'd help us for a while, but then they tore the wheel up, so they couldn't cut us out no more. And 40, 50 years ago, it was cold. The fish, this deep. The crabs, this deep. The day, the year the bay froze over, that next year, the crabs was this deep. Don't give me the 2 to 4 degree water temperature, because Chesapeake Bay that year was froze. Damn, that wasn't colder than 2 to 4 degrees, so I'm not biting on no water temperature. With all I've ever heard about for the last 10 years is global warming. And now you throw it in this water temperature. That's out. Because nobody here remembers that. I know somebody here. Pete, I know damn well at some point in time you had to bust ice to get out of the harbor.
I didn't go to graduate until 78.
Well, I started in 1970. And I heard stories from the old-timers who originally started dredging. And a 100-year fisher we killed, stopped, did, stone dead. This worries me that this kind of dropped. My question to you, Ron, is what happens next year if this same thing occurs, if we have this tremendous drop again? What happens then?
So what
if we don't do nothing now, and I'm hoping this is just an oddball thing that maybe next year it'll bounce back. Maybe it's just an oddball thing. 23 years, it sounds like, well, I would, 23 years, maybe it'll bounce back. If it bounces back next year, we look like geniuses if we didn't do nothing. If it drops again.
Let me ask something way different than this. Abundance is pretty much determined by how much larvae go out of the bay and how many come back. And everything I've ever read since the beginning was it all depends on wind and water currents. So I spent, 2 or 3 hours this morning trying to research wind and water currents.
Yeah, there's a group right now of physical oceanographers who actually have all those data sets, and they're now just started working with us actually to use our dredge survey data, trawl survey data, and to try to determine which of those atmospheric conditions or whatever, whether it's wind, currents, and such, might be driving the population. Yeah, we believe for quite a while and have data for that that shows that. If you look at the abundance in a given year and how that changes from year to year, about half, we can explain about half of that, no more than half, by how many females there are in the spawning stock and so on. The other half is of the mother nature.
Right.
And so now we're trying to understand that more because now they have the really complicated models and simulations that are getting better and better and better. But we're still at a point where, yeah, half of it, it could happen like Tropical Storm Angus said is in 72, and boom, all of a sudden everything collapsed.
It's almost like it doesn't matter what we do, they're going to do their own thing, really. I mean, it's basically out of our hands, really.
Well, right, but at least you'll know that you'll have something.
Well, no, so what we're trying to do because of that, and that's where we deal with things like what we call resilience, we want to make sure that there are enough females there so that if something does happen, that they can still come back a year or two. Because, the blue crab can come back in a year or 2 years. It can also collapse in a year or 2 years. So that's what we're managing when we can manage it. We think that we manage the spawning stock, keep it at this level, that there are enough females there, so even in a bad environmental event, whatever, that we'll still be able to produce enough offspring. And that's what's happened. Right now, the spawning stock is remaining between the target and threshold. So it's still in what we consider a safe area.
I talked to one of the aquarium biologists in Louisiana a couple of years ago, and I was asking him about that. He laughed. He said, I tell you what, he said, I don't see how you guys have any crabs. He said, because you only have that little teeny crab.
Yeah, we did a study some time ago comparing the Gulf and the Atlantic, and the Gulf gets about 10 times more young juvenile crabs coming into their systems than we do. But then what happens to them after that is something else, because you got predation, you got all sorts of other events happening. Yeah.
Anybody have any other questions? And Lipschitz, Ron, I should say, is a wealth of information and a lot of experience, obviously. Yes, sir, Mr. Sanders.
Bob Crash, Dredge Farm. How long is your actual total when it hits the bottom?
112 yards.
112 yards.
Each one.
And how long does that take?
A minute.
A minute.
1 minute on the bottom.
And that's when it hits the bottom, is that correct? Or when you let it out?
When it hits the bottom.
So and over 3 minutes. Then you're off to the your next site?
Yes.
So basically you're on the bottom. A minute.
Had 3 knots.
And your speed also?
3 knots.
3 knots?
Yep.
What about the ratio to that?
1/8 to 3.7 knots.
We have a set chart that's consistent with depth of how much chain that we put out. Put it roughly 3 to 1, yep. Maybe a little more.
And then do you compensate for tide?
We always tow in the same direction with the tide.
You always tow with the tide.
I mean, we try to do it as consistently.
Well, that's,
I mean, we're not fishing. We're trying to sample and do it the same way every time we put that dredge in the water.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, sir, Mr. Reynolds.
Ron, I've got a quick question. What's the average weight that you use for the female crabs and male crabs? I know what Noah uses.
We're using something like 2.5 females to the pound.
Roughly. Noah puts out roughly. They say a third is 0.33.
Yeah, about 2.5 to 3. Yeah, females to the pound.
So we're good to say a third.
Yeah.
Right. Thank you.
Okay.
Ron, you still didn't answer me what you think happened about it with the numbers put down in 1 year.
Well, we're trying to figure that out right now. That's what we're doing. That's why I said that I now just started to look at the data for each of the different regions where we sample from the winter dredge survey, see if there's something localized, see if we're looking at the size of all the crabs. Are we now, has the size structure changed so that maybe we're not categorizing them correctly? So we're looking at that right now as part of the benchmark stock assessment. Because it's troubled me the same way it's troubled you. Like, why is it, too, that we have those low numbers of juveniles, but yet the females are still doing okay? So there are inconsistencies in what we're seeing, and we know that, and we're trying to figure that out.
You know, one of the things I asked one of the girls at MRC to do when you had 71 million pounds, and Reynolds was talking about how many crabs to the pound. I asked him to tell me how many crabs that was. 71 million pounds, what does that break down to as far as crabs? How many crabs it is? You ladies get that?
I've got all the numbers. I actually did all the math.
But see, I understand why I want to know how many crabs 71 million pounds are.
It's not making sense, and maybe you can explain it to us. According to the catch survey, the reason why I wanted those numbers today, we're saying that the dredge survey is saying there's 26 million males. According to there's 103 million juveniles. There was 26 million males in the Chesapeake Bay. According to the dredge survey, and then last year's harvest was 23 million pounds. That's 69 million males. And the dredge survey says there's only 25 million males in the Chesapeake Bay. The female harvest represents 19.5 million pounds, which is 58,500 crabs, which is over half of the females that are in the entire Chesapeake Bay. So we're saying that we're harvesting three times the amount of males that are in the entire Chesapeake Bay. We're harvesting them, and we're harvesting over half the females according to the numbers provided by the dredge survey.
Yep. You have to include the juveniles. We're not harvesting just those age one.
It said adult females harvested.
And
adult males are
right.
And then it says in here, it says juveniles have their own category. It's 103 million juvenile crabs, according to the dredge survey.
Right, but those are going to grow, and so what we say is that you have to add in
not a stagnant
system. At the start of the year, you've got we add the juveniles and the adults together, and then they're harvested. So it's not just the fraction that's harvested are females. I would say that probably only, from our data, only about 15% of those females, the adult females, make it to the next year. Most of the females we catch are brand new females that would come from the juveniles and those immature crabs. This goes way back to Ben Engel had it right. He said that only about 15% of the females make it to the next year, to the next winter. And that's what we've done. So that's where the discrepancy is you have to add both the juveniles and the adults to figure out what the percentage is from the harvest.
It's not math for me. Maybe I'm a little bit dense. But
okay, so here's...
You're not dense. Listen to him real quick.
I'm listening. What I'm trying to say is we're separating everything in the joint address survey. Everybody reads it as juveniles, adult females, adult males, and then we look at our adult harvest of males and females. And if general public, like myself, if you will, reads it, it does not read okay.
Right.
It reads terrible.
So maybe we need to clarify that better, because that the harvest is through the whole year. And so it includes the crabs that are growing and becoming legal size all the way through the year. And so that's the harvest. But the initial data comes from that one point in the winter. And that, to get the harvest, get the fraction harvested, you have to add together the juveniles and adults. You can't just go with the adults.
Those juveniles will be entering the fishery in August.
We'll go to that then. There's 258 million crabs in the Chesapeake Bay according to the Dredge Survey. Last year, if we just use roughly the numbers that we harvested half of that number.
That's according to mandatory board, right?
That's according. That's not even including recreational numbers.
Yeah.
So it's not jiving in the sense of, yes, I understand we're growing. Predation as a whole. So that's why I'm saying the numbers don't add up. We can say the juveniles are included. Well, that's fine. But we're talking about adult crabs harvested on just the commercial sector, and then the total number of crabs in the Chesapeake Bay, and we're harvesting over half just on the commercial sector. And I understand we have a growth, so even if we have twice that go from juveniles to adults, we're still harvesting one-third of the crabs in the entire Chesapeake Bay on just the commercial sector.
And we're harvesting probably 30% or so of the crabs. We are harvesting around 30% of crabs. What might be missing from that is when we increase the number of crabs that are juveniles by that factor that we're missing. And I think if you put all that together, you'll see. And the exploitation rates, well, it's right there. So you can see it's 30% females, 22%. So we're harvesting roughly 27-28%. Of all the crabs in the bay.
So between
that includes the eight zeros and the adults.
So between what we harvest, which is dyes, the skull just dyes, predation, and all that, I mean, how many, so what do we take, like 75% of the crabs out for the year, basically? I mean, I'm saying, I know we can't quantify the predators, but you know, they're going well, they're doing well, they're eating every 365 days a year. You figure with what they eat, plus, you know, some are just
that's what we're saying. There's another 50%. We already we're rolling that in.
So what I'm hearing, it wouldn't take a whole lot to we'd have a major problem. It wouldn't take much to have a major problem.
Or it's just saying that something's missing. And I mean, I'm just saying that.
You know, if you look at the history from back in the 50s and 60s and all the way through, what we see now with the spawning stock is at a reasonable level where the population recovered. The only time it had a problem was after Agnes in 72,
Ron, excuse me. You said 50s and 60s. Where's that information at? I'm the only one here been doing it for 50 years.
We have that in the trawl, Ben's trawl survey, but we don't use it because it was slightly changed in the years. And so what we like to use are the consistent data that we have. But Van Engel was sampling back in the 50s, started doing that. And so I've looked, I've seen that data. And
you saw it when they were this deep. You saw that.
It used to be, yeah, and when you, what you're saying, that those years, the late 70s, the blue crab population recovered between 1977 and 78 from Agnes. It was way down. It recovered in 77, 78, and then it hit some peaks in the 80s. And fishing pressure was not as high then. The population was doing well, so it could withstand some kind of percent mortality. Now, the overwintering mortality usually doesn't exceed 10-15%. Unlike what happened, if you're familiar with Delaware, I think it was 1977, they had a major freeze and collapsed the blue crab fishery.
I grabbed drugs that one time.
Yeah.
They tried to put me in jail.
Totally
they didn't try to put
but
me
we
in
don't
jail.
Get that. They got like 50-60% or some huge fraction. So even in the worst of winters, we're going to see 10-15% maybe. So it's not going to be a huge hit. And the population was doing really well. Right then, 78 was a banner year.
Well, here's another question. You know, I've served on this board for 30 years. And over those 30 years, we have did regulation after regulation after regulation. And it's still nowhere even close to what it was when I was a younger fella. And after all these years, it's still nowhere close to what it was before we started this. Everybody's got to realize that is for regulation now for 30 damn years I've done this, sit here and listen to this. For 30 years we'll do this. And it's I don't see where it's no even close to what it was in the 70s, 80s, and 90s.
So we
closed the fishery that was for 100 years. Shut it right down. So there's got to be something wrong. Somebody's doing something wrong. You don't go 30 damn years and pass regulation after regulation after regulation and close a 100-year fishery down and still.
Yeah, that
it should go this way. Not
only,
this way.
But
not
the
100-year
fishery was only about 6 million pounds during the peak years, which meant there was about 15% of all the fisheries. It's the crab pot fishery, just the big fishery. And the other way I look at this, we did this with some modeling that if had those regulations not been put in place, like especially when we started with the sanctuary and the others, we might have collapsed the population.
I agree with that.
I do agree with you that we have not gone back to the.
But you say crab grudge fish was only 15%. I remember, and I know Pete goes back this far, there were 300 boats in this fishery. And it wasn't uncommon back when I was a young man that every one of them damn boats caught 25 barrels a day. Not baskets, but barrels.
You know, Marshall, there's one thing. I've said this in meetings here. I've said it in meetings in Maryland. We had one thing in the 70s that made it as good as it was in the late 70s, early 80s, up to the 90s, and that was James River whole system all the way to the Hampton Tunnel was closed for half a dozen years or more. The whole thing turned into a sanctuary. And when they opened up, it was just about time. I think I started crabbing a year after that. And there was it was amazing how many crabs were viewers, get cut off at 9,000 viewers.
But my problem is, after all these years, at least we should do this, at least a little teeny bit.
Yeah, well, this is just my perspective from the James River and the river area. We were prompted by a couple of guys from Saxon to try Peter. I never even thought of them. Didn't have anywhere down there. We already sell you. And I said 50 pots to Lafayette River in 1982 or 30. I didn't know anything about it. I just ran them out in a line from inside Grand Street Bridge to the first turn mark. Had 1,800 crabs. ended up doing is I went over to the Nansman crab and over to Choctaw, and they were just as abundant over there, and they stayed like that until one man came down from Saxis named Bill Bailey. And he heard about us carrying crabs over to George Sands. And he came over there and tied up at where Johnson's are now. I can't think of the guy's name, but that was that proper. And I went around there, and there's Choctaw all full of crab pots before I ever even started. And then everybody and their little brother from the western shore and everywhere came down. You could step from pot to pot outside Bennett's Creek if they would support you. You'd never get your feet wet. It seems like after that went on for 2 or 3 years, it wasn't even worth doing it when we quit. I think that's when this collapse started.
Wait
a minute, there was one other thing that happened at the same time. I never thought about this until about a year or two ago. It was 1974, I think, when Game and Inland Fisheries, in their utmost smartness, introduced a blue catfish in the Jenkins. So we've been 50 years with blue catfish, and 50 years after they opened the Jenkins River. Because the James River, I don't know whether people appreciate this or not, but the James River, when the crabs come out of there, they don't have to run through much of a pond. They get to Hampton Tunnel, and in the spring, the sanctuary starts at the old hotel there, the Nansman Hotel. It's only just a mile down the beach, and then they're free and clear. That's been like that since the 40s. And all they had to do was get out of the James River, come out of Pocosin, and you go right down to there, and they're safe. Now, with the laws we have, we've run everybody up the river far as we can go. And it's just gotten beat down, and beat down, and beat down, and beat down. And what you get is you get, like you saw this spring, you get the odd year that you go, what the hell happened, where'd they come? But, you know, I guarantee you we'll be right back to the same old thing. So the feeding stuff must be doing pretty good out there to support the biomass. At some point in time, whether we see them or not, there's a lot of stuff on the bottom to keep that stuff fed and to help at the population levels it is. So we can't even send that out there and still be supporting all these other species. I mean, they don't get that big out of the past animal diet. That's why I have a problem with just throwing regulations and stuff. But I haven't seen where it's, I mean, they don't.
Mr. Chairman, I got one more thing I want to talk about. Down here at the bottom here, I hope this goes into minutes, because it says here that in 2026, Virginia, Merlin, NOAA, Chesapeake Bay office, they're going to come out with results. And I'm going to tell you what the results are going to be, what they're going to say the problem is. Catfish, drum, spot, croaker, any fish you can name is after a crab to eat. Even turtle. I've even seen seagulls up in the marsh on the seaside where a saw crab would be up there. I've seen a damn seagull dive down and get it. Everything is after a crab. And the only thing that I've seen that they ever try to control is us. You've got environmental impacts. You've got runoff from farmland. All the houses being built. You've got sewers going into water. And that's what these people will come up with. I don't know how much money they spent to come up with that. That's one of the big problems in the Bay is just what I just got through saying. So when this comes out in 2026, I want to see just how close I was to what they say the problem is. And that's when I say I could have saved them a whole lot of money and just told them what they were going to come up with. But the only thing that's ever been done to help this situation is has hurt us. But I'll go back to what I originally said. After 30 years of passing regulations, at least climb the mountain a little teeny bit.
Well, it's a complex issue, obviously, but we got to keep on going. All right. Does anybody have any other questions with regard to the survey? Anything else?
It's not so much a survey. Do you have a number on how many active crabs for 2024?
For Virginia, I don't have Baywide.
Yeah. So, did we decrease, increase? How was the overall average?
I don't know if I have. Yes, I do eventually have last year's harvesters.
Okay.
Yeah, we went down last year on harvesters. Remember that? We went down on a number of harvesters last year from the year before.
Probably.
All right.
So, moving on to commercial harvest data. Thank you for teeing that up, Mark. 2024, Virginia's harvest, and now this does include the seaside areas. We harvested 15.4 million pounds. That was a 17% decrease from 2023. As usual, hard crab pots were about 97%, peeler pots 3%, and the other gears were about 0.1%. The dockside value decreased 17% to $34 million. We had 745 harvesters who reported 43,000 trips. The number of trips was a decrease of 10%. And I do know there's another slide with the harvesters, so we'll get to that a little later. So here's commercial harvest and effort since 1994. You can see the decreases last year from the year before. And then this is that versus value. And all the values are adjusted with the consumer price index to 2024 dollars. Here's crab pot harvest by month. The bars are the 2024 harvest. The orange line is the five-year average. So in just about every month other than March and December, if you want to count that, we were slightly below average. Here's our crab pot harvesting. 57% of our eligible crabbers reported harvest. Okay, so here's the, in 2024, we had 745 harvesters, down from 772. So the first three columns are harvest in pounds for each month. The next three is number of trips, and then number of harvesters. And then that table on the right is just a reminder that for 2025, this data is highly preliminary. You know, March, we've got 91% of crab licensees have reported. So that number isn't likely to change very much. But for April, only 78% of harvesters have reported so far. So, you know, take that value with a grain of salt for now.
Well, that value will only go up.
Yeah.
So more harvest on a worse survey.
So March harvest was down from both 2023 and 2024. April is higher than 2024. And then we'll see how it stacks up against 2023.
Mr. Wright.
Your trips in March should account for some of that. And we all know what the water temperature was. I don't think any of us started on March 17th this year compared to what we had the past couple of years. So that March number, that's water temperature plus your amount of trips and all of it, is much lower than it was in 23 and 24.
Mm.
In 25, our harvest is up on a worse survey with less trips. We don't have, you know, we're missing 22% of our reports. Just doesn't quite correlate, as we've already said. I'm not going to be the devil on today.
So any questions on harvest?
I got one. What do you consider other yields?
Other gears would be scrape, crab trap, trot line. I don't think we had any dip net last year, but crab pound. Well, we have a list of legal gears you can use to harvest crabs, and I think it's only crab pound listed in that. All right, so moving along the agenda, on to discussion of possible management responses. The recommendation for 2025-2026 will be status quo. That would be the same season in bushel limits as last year, which was the hard crab pot season, March 17th to December 16th. With the high bushel limit May 16th through October 31st, and then the low bushel limit outside that. And then peeler pot and all other gears would be April 15th to October 15th, and continuing to recommend closing the winter dredge fishery. And as a reminder of the timeline, on May 15th, CBSAC reviewed the results of the Chesapeake Bay Stock Assessment Committee, reviewed the results of the winter dredge survey. On May 22nd, the press releases went out. Today, May 29th, we're presenting the results at CMAC. On June 24th, these management measures will be presented to the commission for approval. And then currently the stock assessment team is hard at work, meeting probably bi-weekly, if not more, depending on kind of what part people are doing. So we are expecting results in 2026.
Is that stock assessment, does that include dredging and in-do, or is that just modeling?
No, it's basically looking at all the information that we have from everything, and then all that information. No,
so it uses the winter dredge survey. It uses the juvenile trawl, Fort Vim's juvenile trawl survey, Maryland's trawl survey. Up in Maryland, they've got a pot survey. So there's, over the last few years, we've kind of been searching every corner of the bay for who has data that can help, and then requesting that data, and right now they're working with the data. Like Ram said, they're looking at a couple other factors like the temperature and the wind. We're kind of throwing it all in there and seeing what happens and what we can use.
So you're recommending status quo for regulation for the coming year?
Yes. You know, we're keeping in mind that abundance did decrease, but with the benchmark coming out next year, we don't want to kind of preempt the results of that.
Any comments?
So some of the things that come out of the stock assessment are the targets and thresholds we use. And according to those, the fishery has not been overfishing and the population isn't overfished.
Well, I mean, I hope that's the case. I'm not trying to tell anybody that's not going to believe it. I'm just saying I just know when people get together, it seems like they're going to do something. They always do something. Just like when they take something away, they don't do that. When they get together, they're going to do something. That seems like that.
Is there... When this stuff comes out, of course, Chesapeake Bay Foundation puts their information out because they've got to generate funding. And the, you know, it's just like you hear Donald Trump talks about, all you ever get is the fake news. And all you ever hear in any of these media things is the headline. Crab abundance is awful. Well, I see you. CBF thing on there the other day says crab abundance is bad. And the first comment somebody made was, "You got to stop crab dredging." You know, but the point I'm trying to make is there any way is anybody willing to buffer a statement like that with the stuff that Ron was putting out? You know, you'd say, "Well, the numbers are low, but looking at it at first, it's deceiving because it's still." This and this and this and this. Now, you'll get most people won't read down past the headline. But some will, and somebody else will say, well, look there, you're wrong because it says this and this. Because what you're going to get next week, or once this gets out, you can say, well, status quo, and everybody's going to go, oh, God, you know, you're taking too many females.
Well,
you know.
Jeff, that's a really good point because we are, in fact, right in the midst of preparing our own statement based on the stock assessment. Such that it's going to say basically what we've been talking about so that it's going to back things up. If you're right, the headlines, they love headlines, you know, crab population.
Well, you know, I was chairman of the Marine Products Board for a year or so, and constantly in there you fight sustainability readings on whatever species it is. We have a problem with crabs in that Monterey Bay aquarium. Now, they affect a lot. You wouldn't believe it. But you go in a restaurant and there's something on the door that says, Monterey Bay says this is good, but don't eat crabs. Or don't eat crab meat because it's not sustainable in Virginia. Maryland's is because they don't have crab in the rivers. And that's the type of headwinds we're fighting along with our, you know, daily grind. You have to, you know, worry about the market. And that drives a lot of.
Well, I promise you that we're gonna take our statement and we are going to go to the press and say, hey, here's what the actual situation is, and it's gonna mirror what the stock assessment committee is saying. I mean, a lot of this we're saying the same thing. It's not overfished, no overfishing, and so we want to maintain the status quo. And so there's no reason all of a sudden implement all sorts of new management measures right now. Until we can try to figure out more about the juveniles, and I totally agree with you, preaching to the choir when you're talking about the effects of predators. I think if we could do something to get rid of catfish.
I mean, I feel like they're a better predator. said, some of the people who fish there 30, 40 years, they used to catch like all the other kinds of catfish now. And the whole summertime, they might only catch three or four that aren't blue catfish.
And worse yet, when there are not enough of them, then they'll eat each other. They cannibalize too. Yeah. So they can do whatever. Yeah.
We've been trying to. We've been trying to promote people to eat it. We've been trying to promote processing. Bill that was going to put like $4 million into processing when it came out, it was $250,000 for processing plants. So it's kind of like they got to build up the processing capability so that they can increase that. So we're up to what, 3.2 million pounds of blue cats a year?
About 3 million.
Yeah.
One of the biggest problems is that's the trophy fishery and it's those monsters.
It doesn't matter. There's not nowhere else in the United States where a non-native species has any kind of protections on it. So I don't care how trophy it is or nothing. At what point it has to be somebody got to step up and say that. I mean, I don't see how there's no deal with that invasive species. I don't see how there's any scientist or any.
I don't think anybody's protecting it. Well, maybe.
If they're protecting
not
the
just trophy, agency.
No, but if they're protecting still, I mean, that's. Yeah.
Well, and there was a bill this year to remove that protection.
I mean, the only thing is, it's getting less and less crabbers every year and stuff like that. And eventually, you got to look at your problems. I mean, like I said, they eat everything. It's not just crabs. You know what I mean? That's a big portion of the diet. But, I mean, everything goes up the rivers to get big. It doesn't, stuff don't go out there. It still goes up the rivers. That's where the catfish, that's where the prey at.
And one of the things that we're looking at is the peak abundance in the river. Is upriver, like just in New York, for instance, it's just south of West Point, just downriver of West Point, every one of those, and that's where blue catfish are phenomenally abundant.
Chris?
Yeah, I would just say, you know, in addition to the processing money, which...
The juveniles, I'm talking about.
There is a marketing work group that was set up by legislation 2 years ago. We're actually meeting here early next month, and then you will be calling.
Yep.
There is an invasive catfish work group that is very live, about 6 hours.
Yeah, because it's got every stakeholder you can think of. We've got commercial watermen, we've got academics, we've got marketers, we've got processors, we have trophy anglers, we have like legislative assistants, really anyone who's doing anything on catfish is here coming together, kind of sharing news, sharing research, sharing resources. Like, hey, we've got, you guys are holding a tournament? Hey, can we come get gut samples to study what they're eating? So, it was a long meeting because there's a lot of people and a lot of pieces. And out of that work group, there is a few sub-work groups. So the marketing and processing team are kind of working together on how can they improve things? And
there's a policy work group that's actually meeting tomorrow on this. So, I mean, there's a lot being done. There's a lot being done. And one of our biggest issues when it comes to processing is a couple of years ago, a congressional delegation in the Midwest wanted to protect their catfish farms. So they
I can see where they're coming from. I mean, I can.
Right.
They'd have to be full of a fishery of that scale and go wide open.
Yeah, so they put catfish under USDA inspection. So the only fish or shellfish that we have.
Nope.
Still there.
There's been bills introduced, but it sounds like the farm bill has a lot going on right now. So I don't think they're anticipating anything happening on that soon.
Offset the cost of the inspector, so the processors aren't necessarily paying the inspectors anymore. That's happened a couple times, but that's what we've been. I mean, that's what the Bay Foundation has been fighting for, is to remove the inspection requirement, both in the farm bill and in other ways.
In addition to paying the inspectors, if you're processing rockfish and someone brings in a load of catfish, you have to stop processing rockfish, clean the entire. So it's.
So does anybody want to make any comments with regard to what sounds like we'll be going to in front of the commission on June 24th.
Yep.
Any
motion for status quo?
Okay. Second. Any discussion? All in favor?
Status quo.
Been a motion made for status quo.
December 16th, I think, is a Tuesday. I'd like to see a good pushback to December 20th to get the full week, especially with the possibility of the dredge survey not being efficient because of the stuff on the bottom this year. And, participation last year in December was 78 individuals compared to 96 the year before, or 98.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, December is always low.
March 17th is also a Tuesday.
Yeah, so, could we also do March 16th? That way we have 4 weeks to actually get a day, to get a full weekend. How do y'all feel about that? March 16th?
Personally, I don't see where 3 days will make a breakthrough.
I mean, Christmas and December always helps.
Well, I do like the end of that week, that being a Tuesday. Say you're trying to work through a week and you have, how well it is in December, we're getting more weather or something like that. You can't get out there and get your pots up for a couple of days. Mm-hmm. You don't know it. Going through the weekend where you have to take off on Sunday, if your weather report gets worse, you get out too long. You go through the end of the week, you can make a plan ahead of time to get stuff up without having to miss a day or two.
Yeah, it is nice to start on Monday.
Yeah. What is the day that's Saturday? Is that the 20th or 21st?
Saturday's the 20th. Yeah, Saturday's the 20th.
And Sunday's the 20th. Saturday's the 19th.
Yeah, Friday's the 19th, Saturday's the 20th.
So you want to adjust, amend the motion for the dates that we mentioned on the closing to the 20th?
The 20th of December instead of the 16th. That would give us a full week to get our gear up, if we do have that, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
December is important for that.
We good with that adjustment?
I'm good with that.
Okay.
I would just like to hear what, I'm good with it. I'd just like to hear what staff has to say about it like that. Is three, four days going to?
It's not a lot of effort in December.
We've closed on the 20th before.
Yeah.
The decrease in 15 people, I think there's not 60.
Sorry?
The effort.
You might not have had everybody watching them anyway.
Yeah. We may be doing this just for a couple people, but.
If I remember correctly, last year, staff were. When we went through this back in August, you guys were good with going through, giving us the extension to the end of December, but not the early part of March, right? Wasn't that the recommendation?
Mm-hmm.
So I would think the 20th would be fair.
And we'll open also on the 16th.
17th of March through December the 20th.
Okay.
This is all right. Start on that Monday. If you're going to do that, you're going to start.
Don't push.
All right. All in favor of the amended time?
March 17th through December the 20th?
Yeah.
Any opposed?
Any noes? Okay. All right.
Thank you, everyone. Next up, we're going to be talking about the Terrapin petition. So I'm going to hand that over to Pat.
If you enjoyed that, you're going to really love this conversation. Just want to really make a quick note. Our YouTube feed is not working properly. If anybody's, is it working at all? So what we'll do is we are getting the audio. We will have the presentation, and we'll put that online. So if anybody was trying to listen in or wants to get it afterwards, we'll have it up there instead. Here we go. We received a petition regarding protection for diamondback terrapins
to require what they call bycatch reduction devices in near-shore waters. It was submitted to us in February 12th of this year, and the petitioners are shown there. Two Virginia organizations, the Center of Biological Diversity has offices here, and a researcher at Ohio University. What this petition was asking for was requiring the bycatch reduction devices in all licensed commercial and recrational blue crab pots, where it was in waters less than the waters that were 150 yards from shore at mean low water. So, and they gave some more descriptions on that, but it's pretty much a 150-yard buffer around the shoreline. And when they said they want, if the petition gets approved, they want it done within the next 3 years. So it wasn't. I thought that was very kind of them to give us 3 years to. Let me finish. Okay. What a petition is. I've talked to Mark about this. A petition is something that anybody can. Anybody, and that doesn't have to be a resident of the state, can petition an agency to request the agency to develop new regulations or amend existing regulations. And the petition must have substance, purpose to rulemaking. They have to mention what rules they want changed, include references to Virginia Code and things like that. And we have to address it in a specific format. So anybody can do that. So far to date, this has only been in place since about 2019, I think, is when it first started, maybe 2020. Most of the ones we're getting are from Menhaden. We get at least one a year from Menhaden. We had one for Hickory Shad that we had as well. So, but how that petition works is they submit the petition to the agency, and then the agency has 14 days once they receive it to send it to the Register for Regulations, and it gets published in what's called the Virginia Regulatory Town Hall. So if you just type in Virginia Town Hall, you can see all the ones that are up there for all the different agencies. There's a 21-day public comment period that's online on the Town Hall website. That's where you comment from. And after that, there's a 90-day, after the public comment period ends, the agency has 90 days to address this with comment. What we do with our agency is, because we have public hearings at our commission meetings, we have the petitioner come in and present their petition to the board. So we have 90 days to do that. So since the public comment period started on March 10th and ended the 31st, so we have to have 90 days to hear that, so we have to hear it by our June meeting. So that's why June 24th we'll be bringing this petition up. And then what it is, the board is just deciding whether or not they support the petition or not. It's a yes or no answer, pretty much. If they say no, the person can appeal. If they say yes, then we start the process for changing the regulations. Good question, because we haven't had to do that yet. We haven't had an appeal yet, so okay. usually they just submit it again. That's what you know that.
Okay.
Yep. Joe, do you know the answer to that one?
They can't appeal.
They can't?
They cannot appeal. The commission denies the petition. All they can do is resubmit. They cannot appeal the decision of the commission under a petition for rulemaking. It dies at the commission.
Okay.
It's unappealable by law.
Okay.
So that's where we have the other ones that come back year after year. That's the only way they can make us see it again, is they can go through the process again. But they cannot appeal a commission ruling if it's not.
Okay. Thanks, Joe. This is the process, and we do this for all these. There's an introduction of the whole process, how it works, and that's what I'm giving you today. And then the petitioner gives their presentation, usually about 10 minutes. The staff will get up and say, this is information we have as well in addition to that. And then there's a public comment period where people will come up and talk, and that's determined by the chair. It's usually 3 minutes, but if there's 150 people in the room, they might limit that. We have had, for Menhaden, it's been a full room if you've ever been to one of those. But the public comment period is now closed, so if you want to comment on this, you'll have to show up at the meeting. That's the last place to comment. So, and I'll show you what the comments have been so far to date. And then after the comment period, the petitioner has another 5 minutes, and then the commission deliberates and they make a decision on that. So the Menhaden ones have lasted
hours,
days. Usually the ones we've done have been, you know, minimum of 2 to 3 hour process in our commission meetings. So depending how many people show up, because you have to have everybody gets a chance to speak if they want to. So, okay, and like I said, the petition process, the commission issues, we will put in a written decision to grant or deny the petition, and if it's granted, we put it in the registrar, and then we start the rulemaking process. And this all goes through what I said, the Virginia Regulatory Town Hall. It's reviewed. If it's denied, it's just we put our summary in the register as well. So like I said, the public comment period on this was March 10th through the 31st. It's a while ago, but this is how this process works. We received 35 comments in support and 425 against. But of the 35, 19 of those presented 18,541 signatures. And of the 424 opposing it, 20 of those represented 20,288 signatures. So it was almost like a petition people signed. Instead of sending in their own letter, they just signed, they all put their name to the same letter, so to speak. And as I already said, the petition will be presented on June 24th meeting. And like I said, that will be the last time. We're not accepting any other public comment except if you come to the meeting at this point. VIMS has sent us a statement as well. They are supportive of having some kind of regulations for having bycatch devices in them. They talked about other alternatives as well, possibly looking at, instead of doing it for the whole waterways, doing it for specific habitats for terrapins. They also said the biggest bang for the buck would be doing it for the recreational fishery. We proposed that back in 2021. I don't know if you all remember. We came to you before, and we said we were just, you know, going to do it for the recreational fishery. Everybody agreed. VIMS agreed. Dr. Randy Chambers, who's a terrapin biologist at William and Mary, agreed and said because of the proximity to the shoreline, recreational fishing, their pots are closer to the shoreline than commercial, so they're more likely to encounter terrapins. Unfortunately, at our June 2021 meeting, the board decided to not approve it and to push it back to CMAQ at some point. So we haven't brought it back because I really know what we're going to bring back with that at this point. But you know what I know at this point. This petition will be moving forward. If CMAQ wants to provide us their opinion tonight, that's great. If they want to have the chairman or anyone else come and speak on behalf of the committee, they can. But you're all welcome to come and provide your own comments at the meeting on the 24th. So,
going back on this issue, one other issue. We have different licenses on the rec.
Yes.
That was about 2018.
It's been a while. And we have, for recreational, we have... You can get for your recreational five-pot license, you can get it with or without a terrapin. If you have terrapin excluders, you get a discount. It's not much. It's like, what was it, $10 cheaper or something?
Yeah.
It wasn't a whole lot. And so, but it's,
So. How many people are flying the license to not have the
TRD? Do you know that off the top of your head? We can get that for you. Yeah, I don't have it with me right now.
No, I think that was what made it change. Why people aren't using the recreational guys.
Yeah. Well, in fact, when we did this back in 2021, the secretary was going to give us money to buy, crates of those to give out to the recreational fishery. And unfortunately, we didn't buy them before the commission voted on it.
I just want to show everybody what he's talking about. This is a common 10-mesh phone that I make in my grandma, and you can install this is the smallest one they sell, and you put it on the inside of the website, and I just fasten this one on the website because it's easier to Wi-Fi. If I pass around, anybody not familiar with it, so you can look at it. But this is what you're talking about. This is what you have to put in your grandpa.
If anybody starves to death.
Yeah.
I mean,
Let's go to Mark, and then we'll go to Marshall.
My question is, a study was done, and what did the study come up with? Are the commercial crab is a problem? Are the recreational crab is a problem?
I can tell you from personal experience that the proximity to the marsh edge is going to be more important. So most recreational people are putting their pots off their docks or in shallow water, close, you know, small creeks. So the recreational, in my opinion, from what I've done with research I've done, not in this state, somewhere else, recreational pots are more likely to encounter them.
Right. I mean, I'm totally against any kind of distance from the shoreline, basically, with it. You're going to shut me down, and I'll be out of work.
We're in the process of looking at. We have a new intern for the summer, Danielle Rakel back there, who's she's working on terrapins for her master's degree. So fortunately she's with us for the summer, so it worked out real well. And we're going to start looking at that and seeing, yeah, because you're really talking about 300 yards. So if the creek is small in 300 yards, you're going to be required to have these in the.
Also, in Lynn Haven itself, the boating traffic there is terrible. If I go even try to put my pots away from the shoreline, I'll be devastated, destroyed. They'll be cut off in no time.
Yeah, just real quickly, we started looking at a map and just making some measurements. Hampton Creek out here would require it because it's. And Sarah's Creek on the York River would be, parts of Lynn Haven would be, several creeks on the eastern shore would be required to have them in it.
Eastern shore seaside,
70 miles apart. Yeah. Yeah. Get ready to do that. On the eastern shore seaside, we'd be in big time trouble.
Yeah, yeah.
When you said 150 yards, that's 1,800 foot from side to side.
Yeah.
That's a lot of places. And on top of that, a lot of folks don't know, the crabs on the seaside are smaller.
Ken, go ahead, Marshall.
The crabs on the seaside are a lot smaller.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of our crabs are going through that, even when the cold rains come.
But
we have smaller crabs on the shore. And on top of that, a lot of our marshes from side to side.
Yeah.
So you're cutting off a tremendous amount of area.
I mean, the VIMS recommendation was, you know, maybe looking at specific habitat, you know, hot spots was one of the things
Are you looking from the crab committee to make a decision whether we agree with it or don't agree with
I know you could.
I can handle that.
If you guys want to make, you know, no, I know, I think I know the answer already, but you're more than welcome to.
Mr.
Hodges.
How do they require a petition to put these in commercial crab pond when the species is not endangered in the state of Virginia? It's only endangered in two states of the 17 on the East Coast, New Jersey and New York. And they don't require them in their pots, even though it's considered endangered. If a species is not endangered, why do we have to have regulations to do this?
The only states that require it commercially are New York and New Jersey, which basically their fishery didn't exist 20 years ago, so. And it's a very small fishery. North Carolina has it in two specific areas that require it. A few more states do require it recreationally. And so it's, you know, we can't help what a petition is. If someone wants to put a petition in, we have to consider it.
How is our population over in Virginia, is my question, where we're at? How are we looking over there?
They are threatened.
By what?
It's Dr. Randy Chambers is probably the best expert in the state.
Let me tell you a little bit about the cost of this. I don't know if y'all ever bought it or not. I went to Ocean Rock. This piece of plastic here was $1.50. You got to have four of them in each crab box.
Each funnel.
Our size is another $2. $8 per crab box which you're going to spend to put this in the crab box.
Y'all might not
care.
I think Marshall would be ready to leave.
Marshall had something to say.
You're ready to make a motion. And you're going to present that to VMRC.
We will have it on when we have the recommendations and the staff recommendations, we'll have VIMS recommendations, and we'll have CMAX recommendations. I can't say it this time.
I'll make a motion that we support escape panel and recreational pots, but we do not support commercial pots.
If I'm saying you do that, you open
Okay, so your amendment is?
Dropped it all.
To oppose it entirely.
Yeah, oppose it all.
Make the motion. I dropped it. Make the motion. Yeah, you have discussion after the motion is made.
With the studies that were done, it clearly shows that the recreational crab potter is the issue. Is that correct?
From my personal experience and research that I have done, that's what I saw. But that was not in this state.
What we showed is that two-year study that the commercial fishery was not the problem. And in fact, when you look at the recreational, I think you need to distinguish between the recreational, the licensed recreational pond holders, right? That's five, versus the homeowners who can put out two. If I had my, this is just my opinion, if I had my druthers, I would say require them for all the homeowners. Those things are right there on the shore. Yeah. Sometimes they're left out the soap.
Days and days.
I wish that could happen.
Yeah. Ron made a good point because we have the five pot license that we know how many of those are.
But if a guy's going to be in the five pot license, chances are he's going to be in the boat. He's not going to be throwing.
Chances are he probably is, yeah. Everybody in the state's allowed to put out two pots, and we don't license that at all. Everybody's allowed to have two. So we don't have any idea what that number is.
I'd like to make a motion to deny the petition altogether.
I'll second that.
Okay.
Okay, we'll take that forward. Anything else?
We'll vote on it.
Have a
second.
We're talking a lot about recreational box. The commission can't actually put it on the two boxes. Right? We can require that as a commission.
Don't know. I think if we say recreational pots, it's a recreational pot. I think it would adhere to it. I mean,
isn't the homeowner still under recreational use?
It's considered a recreational pot, but we just don't license it.
I think you made a good point. Why start a statement?
Okay, we have a motion and a second to do nothing,
to deny the petition.
All in favor, raise your hand. Okay. Any no's in the crowd of us? No. Okay. All right. Good deal. The next thing on the agenda is other business. License wait list starts the other business.
So earlier this year, two watermen on the wait list came to one of our commission meetings and at the public comment section asked for their crab pot licenses to be reinstated. It was recommended that CMAC discuss the issue, so we're bringing it to you today. So background, in 2008, a blue crab fishery disaster was declared for Chesapeake Bay. Overcapitalization of the fishery, overfishing, and latent effort were identified as issues that should be addressed. BMRC's Blue Crab Regulatory Review Committee said effort control is hampered by substantial latent effort. Latent effort being potential effort that's unused. So people who have licenses that aren't fishing them, or people who aren't putting out maximum pots, but if they chose to, they could start fishing, and it could substantially increase harvest. So here's the relevant language in Chapter 1040. For any lawful commercial crab fishery, those registered commercial fishermen who are eligible from 2004 through 2008 for any crab pot or peeler pot licenses but reported no harvest from 2004 through 2007 were placed on a waiting list in 2009, and shall remain ineligible to purchase a commercial crab pot or peeler pot license in accordance with subsection C of this section. And subsection C establishes a criteria that would open the wait list, which is currently 215 million age 1-plus female blue crabs, or blue crabs 2.4 inches and greater in carapace width, and until that has been attained in three consecutive Baywide Blue Crab winter dredge surveys. Originally, that 215 was 200 million crabs. That's any age and sex. When it was introduced in 2000, for 2009, it was amended to 215 million female crabs in 2011 after the stock assessment, which established 215 million female crabs as the target, what we were aiming for. That has actually since been an update to the stock assessment, brought the target down to 196 million crabs. And an appeal process was added in 2009 for specific circumstances, which would be if you couldn't fish for health, active military service reasons, or if there was a substantial error in the mandatory harvest records. And for reference, we've been above the 215 million crabs twice since this was enacted, but not consecutively. So originally, the wait list was 524 hard crab pot licenses and 343 peeler pot licenses for a total of 867 licenses. Currently, the wait list is at 63 hard crab pot licenses, 25 peeler pot licenses for a total of 88 licenses. And those 88 licenses represent 71 individuals because some people had both. A crab pot and a peeler pot license. The reason for that decrease is there's a few different reasons. If you crab dredged during the that 2004 to 2007, if you had crab dredge harvest, they exempted you. If you sold your license during the disaster buyback program, you came off the wait list. Watermen who no longer have a commercial card or who have passed away, and people who have since transferred into the fishery by transferring a license from someone else. So this represents how many of each license are on the waiting list and what the potential latent effort is. So there's that first column is the what license it is, how many pots the license is for, the number of those licenses which are on the wait list, and then how many pots that would add into the fishery if every pot was fished, every pot of every licensee. So in total, hard crab pots, if all wait list licensees fish their pots, it could increase the number of pots in the water by 7%. That's over the current active pots, so not our... not the number of pots that people are eligible to fish, but the number people are fishing currently, number that are reported. And active peeler pots could increase by 15%. So here's a quick look at latent effort in the current fishery. You know, when this wait list went into effect, we were at 73% of our eligible crab pot licensees, hard crab pot licensees, were reporting harvest, and that's declined to 57% last year. And for peeler pots, it went from 62% in 2009 to 29% last year. So, yeah, big difference. And here's what that looks like a little more specifically. So, again, the first column is what license it is. The second column for eligible is how many people are eligible to purchase their crab pot license every year, or peeler pot, in the case of the bottom rows. The next column is how many licenses were sold, how many people actually purchased their license, and this is all for 2024. And then the last column is how many watermen reported harvest. So that's the active. They were actively fishing and reporting harvest. And those total rows, we just multiplied the number of licensees by the potential, the maximum number of pots they could fish. So, for example, if all currently eligible hard crab pot licensees, without touching the wait list, fish next year, all their pots in the water could increase by 38%.
That's without the wait list?
Yeah, without adding in the wait list, if just everyone, that difference between the number eligible and the number active, if they all started fishing last year, if they started fishing this year, that's how many more pots could be in the water. And here is that latent effort by gear as well. I know we're kind of getting out of the waitlist territory, but, you know, we often talk about how difficult it is for people to get into the fishery, and there's a lot of licenses sitting latent, so it might be a topic for the committee to talk about in the future. Well, of the people that came to the commission meeting to ask for their licenses back, I think it was one said they wanted to pass it to a family member, and the other one said they wanted to sell it. Okay. So here are some potential options that we can start the discussion with. One option could be to reinstate all the crab waiting list licensees, but make those reinstated licenses non-transferable for now, for some period. This is transferability could be something revisited after the stock assessment. Reinstate the crab waiting list licensees that did purchase their licenses from 2004 through 2007. So purchased them but didn't harvest. So these are two options. This is for the committee to discuss. We look forward to hearing your thoughts on these or any other suggestions.
Okay. And I know you all have some comments. There we go. Yes, sir.
It's not any question or anything. It is a little bit of discussion. I do feel for some of the people on the waiting list. There's a couple of friends of mine that were like year-round, seeding in James River, all that kind of stuff, that did have their crab license taken away, but they were still actively on the water 24/7. So in some sense, I do feel for them right now, but with everything that's been going on, especially the last couple of years, we didn't want to open crab dredging up until stock assessment and all that came in. I would say do the same thing with this. Revisit this once we got the stock assessment before we, like you just said a while ago, if everybody that bought your crab pot license this year actually went, we could be 38% above with the amount of crab pot. So just my opinion, I'd like to wait.
I think we should get our crab pots back first. All the active people used to 500 pot license and now 425. Everything's reduced. I mean, they should get the fishery back to what it was before we start turning more licenses and people discuss it.
Anybody else?
Yeah,
just one thing I can comment on. I'll tell you, the crab fishery has certainly declined significantly in the last 10, 15 years. I can remember when it was over 2,000 crabbers, active crabbers. And they ain't been that long ago, I'll tell you that. I think it was probably, you guys got a lot more to check out, I'll tell you. Doesn't look good for the fishery.
Someone on.
Yeah, they can get a license.
They can get a license.
Yes,
or
sir.
They could be an agent for somebody on one of these, all these late licenses. They could be an agent for them, and they could be able to use them. But, I mean, I just don't think that's the one thing. And then after that, where they got messed, I just don't think that's
Yeah, so that decrease from the original waitlist number, a lot of that is people who purchased licenses from someone else. They can't transfer their waitlisted license to anyone.
All right, maybe want a motion.
Motion to table this until after the staff assessment.
Second. All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Any nays?
Is there any other information you would want available on this when it would come back on the table?
Whatever the numbers are current at that time.
Yeah, we would update everything you see here.
I mean, to me, 2004, 2007, that's a long way from 2025 where we are today. If somebody wanted to be in there, they would have done it.
And if not, they got enough money, that's all that's holding them up. They've been living on it since then, and I think they're probably all right.
That's fine. Yeah. All right. Can we go? Right. We're almost at 7, and I feel my head hurting already.
So, fortunately, I have many fewer slides for this.
Many fewer, okay.
All right.
Everybody all right with us continuing on?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
So we had a request to discuss the dark sponge law, maybe propose some changes. Is Mr. Farrington here? Did you want to come? Okay. So one of the suggestions was to, once the sanctuary opens, to end the dark sponge law. Was that the, about your gist? So we'd like to hear from the committee what your thoughts are. We did have a CMAQ, a work group in 2021, kind of started throwing ideas out and information we'd want to see, but there weren't any other meetings after that.
I have a question for Ron. Past meetings, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but you said 90% of the black sponge crabs bought in a crab fight and thrown back. Y'all think that?
That's only during when water temperatures are above certain amount, which puts you into July, August timeframes when they die. We did a prior study, I don't know, were you going to show that or no?
I don't have that.
Okay, so we did a prior study that said those tossed back in May and early June, they're going to, really high percentage going to survive. Starting sometime in late June through August, very large fraction of those are going to die.
I think September was still in the 80s, right? Mm-hmm. I think September was still 80-something percent, right?
September through, early September. Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically when the temperatures are hottest. And they die because they're in traps. They don't die because they're handled up on the boat or whatever. It's what's happening in the traps that gets them. So, yeah.
What percentages die when the water's a little bit cool?
It ranges from a couple percent to probably 10%, maybe or so. It's pretty low.
How about if there's a whole bunch of hard crabs with no sponges or yellow sponges in there?
We did not detect any kind of big difference depending on the number of crabs, because when the temperatures are cooler, they're also not as aggressive.
I mean, when they first bust out,
we never did studies with them. We did up to about, let's say, about 10 or so crabs, something like that. We never did.
Well, I'm just saying, I'm in cushions.
So almost in survival, whether a female is carrying, if it's carrying a sponge, if it's not carrying a sponge, if it's orange, if it's brown, black, there was no difference. They were all dying at the same time.
You know, I'd sit there on the boat and keep hose going from barrel to barrel to barrel all morning long, and it still doesn't have to be.
Yeah, that's
all
right.
All right.
Any other questions?
Yeah,
Commissioner
Hall.
This is a serious question for Ron. Ron, excuse me. From a scientific standpoint, if we did want to get rid of the dark sponge law through June the 15th, would that be a detriment to the fishery?
You talking through June 15th?
Yes, sir. Like, get rid of the dark sponge law.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I would say. From about June 15th to about September 15th is when I think there's going to be really high mortality.
Well, I thought we could catch them after June 15th.
We can.
Okay, I'm, well, what I'm giving you the data. The data.
Right, okay. Well, what Spencer's talking about is the few week allowable period that we're allowed to have. It's been cut back. That's what I mean. It's not as long as it was.
Yeah.
And are we going to see a noticeable difference, a measurable difference in that few weeks that we're after we're going to get the ticket?
That's something that we'd have to work on staff and look at the harvest rates, what fraction is being pulled out and so on. It's not anything I can answer to right
on. And unfortunately, we don't have any data on what percent of harvest are sponges or what color sponges. We just have Yeah.
Your records in a study that you did. When was that study? What year?
We did a couple different studies. The one where we did it across the year, that was done in 2007. And then the one that we did in August, we did it twice. We did that with Pete Freeman. And we did that in 2010, around then.
And when your studies were done, I mean, did you actually lump the crabs together and send away dye and wave action or anything like that? At all? Or is it just
which study are you talking about?
Any study. Did you throw them in
real life? Yeah, we put them together, but like I said.
But was it real life conditions, wave action, tide action, or anything like that?
We back in the water.
You put them back, you just put them back in the water?
Mm-hmm. They never in natural conditions where you put a crab on.
So they were in crab on overboard.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, no, they were not taken care of any.
Yeah, because, your mortality
rate. No, it was a field. It was right off there. Yeah.
I think that's the...
Yeah. Okay.
I can tell you right now, Eastern Shore, you go down to Chesapeake State Park, around ferry docks, stuff like that. During the year, you start seeing sponge crabs. Your mortality rate is a lot higher than what you're saying in general.
Well, I mean, they only had 10 crabs in the pot.
If you have 10 crabs in your pot and you're at the ferry docks, you better leave because you're not going to make a dime. You know, we're seeing 2, 3, 4 dozen crabs to the pot. There's cannibalism, there's wave action, and I mean, there's so many other factors that you did not play in. Yeah, you threw them overboard at your place, on the York River, where there's probably not a lot of tide. You have 10 crabs in the pot, and they're just hanging there.
Yeah, I'm not going to disagree. That's what we were able to do.
I think if they come up in their in good shape, it would be different, but that's just not really realistic.
But you also now at this point, before we had no bushel limits whatsoever. Now we have bushel limits for every gear type out there, 85 pot, I don't know. It's minimal compared to what we used to catch. So, I mean, in my mind, here we are catching a crab that we're throwing back that we're going to die. The egg mass is going to die. It's a waste of the resource. Let us catch our 29 bushels on the 250 bottle, whatever it is, and go in. Don't let us stay out there and throw over 40 or 50 bushels to get what we can out of that. People are doing it. People are doing that right now as we speak. They're catching 50, 60 bushels of crabs to keep 10 or 15 because they have to make a day's pay. Do away with it.
not for the full time period.
How long do you think them busted hooks are there? I'm just curious.
How long?
Of that time period that are sitting there, how long do you personally think is that we're dealing with busted hooks that are dark in that time period that we're talking about?
I would say it's probably about 2 weeks, two, 3 weeks maybe. Because they started sponging out sometime in probably early May.
Right.
And so it takes about sometimes 2 to 4 weeks, yeah, depending on water temperature, for them to develop. So,
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
My point in this has always been, is this a cost versus benefit situation? And I discussed this with Jack years ago. I said, Jack, I know what you're doing. I said, you don't really care what the numbers are. You're just trying to get everybody off the sponge creek of any description. And what you're doing is you force everybody way up the rivers to catch mostly males. Now, are we in a situation now with our numbers that I'm looking at here today, 5 million males in Virginia, in a position where we would rather have the crabbers we have working on a low number of males versus being able to spend 2 more weeks down below and stay out of that I don't know what kind of area you want to call this.
So if I were to look at the situation, I would say that from about June 1st on, I think they're probably going to have a pretty high mortality. But I think before June 1st, no. So I think VIMS could probably support something like moving it a couple weeks so that you're not...
You know, Ty, he said when the thing opens in the middle of May, he would rather see it moved to like 1st of January. Why?
No, I'm talking about the sponge. The sponge law. Okay, so I was only talking about the sponge crab law. So that I think would be a reasonable thing that could be supported by the science. I'm not even talking about the sanctuary right now.
And it's only black sponges that you're dark.
Yeah.
Have you done any studies to show the results of that? What benefits are we getting from that? Can you show us anything?
That's what you have to go and work with the harvest data from staff to see what kind of what fraction is being taken out that time, and presumably what fraction is...
Well, I mean, you're sticking to this black sponge law like it's the rules that say.
I'm not the one who was saying it's not a beneficial regulation when it's high, because they are dying. I that's my point the whole time. The only time
you,
I think...
You would support that, doing away with it, is what you're saying.
After June 1st. Yeah, so he's going to... I'm not saying he's giving you anything, but he just said VIMS would support to take it from the 15th to the 1st of June, which is a step in the right direction.
Absolutely. And I'd like to see y'all come out on those in the springtime. I know everybody in the campus one track knows what I'm talking about. I mean, and see what we're saying. I mean, I think if everybody was seeing them thrown back overboard and they had all 10 legs and were swimming off beautifully, I think people might feel a little bit differently, but that's unfortunately. I mean, I just feel like if they're not, if the thing is the sanctuary is, what little bit we catch outside of that certain thing, I don't know.
I did that years ago, carried two commission members out on 3 or 4 different occasions. You know what good it did? Zero.
See it
for
yourself. They talk about crabs.
The general public was big time into the crabs.
And stuff. What's the same thing when we go on the board and it's missing all the slaves?
I will say for this discussion, we don't need a motion. We don't need a final product to come out of this meeting. You know, it's too late to do anything this year. But what we can do is similar to what we did last year with the dredge fishery. If you guys want to come up with questions with data you want to see answered, we can bring those to the next meeting, and we can continue this discussion with more information you feel necessary, or if you guys want to spend the next few months coming up with options you want to send me, and we can have a list of options to start discussions. It can have a decision. You can have a motion today, or we can continue this at another meeting.
We'd started this discussion earlier in the year so that just early, because we could have actually documented the timing for the orange and then the brown and black, because I know it takes a while for them, and if the first time that you see the orange sponges is sometime in early May, then it's not until the end of May that you're going to see the brown and black. I'll ask you, are you guys seeing brown and black sponges now?
Alexa, you said that this could be for a later meeting. Would it be a later meeting this year to where we could make this decision happen before the season next year? Or
it could be. I mean, if you guys say you want to have a meeting this year, we can have a meeting this year.
Well, I mean, considering it's too late for this to go in for this year's regulations, I would think that this would need to be done sooner than later, so it could be ready for next spring before the season starts. Because if they changed it, if them supported the change to June the 1st, that would give them two more weeks, and we wouldn't be making the regulations until the end of June for next season.
But we can make changes to these regulations at any time.
Okay.
I mean, we have to have a given lead time.
Yes, ma'am.
But, June isn't the only time we can hear crab matters.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, what's the pleasure of the commission? We've got to keep moving here.
Sounds like it.
Personally, I would like to hear this sometime this fall or something before.
It's not going to change anything for this year, right?
Yeah, it's not going to change anything for this year, so I'd like to. And then that would give Ron time to wrap his head around it as far as would June 1st work and stuff like that, or possibly even he might say a week before that or something.
And we could start earlier in the day, too.
When you plan on retiring?
2029.
Well, good.
Okay.
And don't take the bucket. We don't want to change the bucket.
All right.
You got to live for the crafts, Rob.
All right, so we're going to save this for later discussion for once we have some more information on it. Is that what we're going to say?
Yes, sir. Okay.
So please, in the meantime, while you're thinking of it tonight, tomorrow, reach out to me with what information you want you didn't see today. And staff, Rom and his team, will work to put together what we can.
Yeah. All right. Well, now we're at public comment. Is there anyone who has something to say from the public that would like to bring up to the commission.
Or elsewhere on the committee?
Committee, excuse me.
I've got something I'd like to bring up.
Okay.
I want to talk about the sanctuaries. We've got five sanctuaries in Chesapeake Bay now. And what I'm looking for is to have consistency within the sanctuaries themselves. You can see them up here. You have A, 1A, 1B, then you have sanctuary 3 and 4, which are regulated by the BMRC. Of course, the historical sanctuary is by the General Assembly. What I'm asking for is consistency with 3 and 4, like 1A and 1B are, which gives you a buffer zone that goes out to 35 foot, I believe. Is that?
No.
It's 30?
It's not even 30 places.
Okay. Well, anyway, what you see there on that map is you're seeing everywhere in the Chesapeake Bay, except the ocean front, which is regulated by the BMRC, they have a place to go. So what I'm asking for is Area 3 to give us, to go to the contour 35-foot open area, and then also Area 4, the same thing. And if you can't go by the contour of the bottom, then give us a mile off the beach for a mile and a half. What we're looking for. And the reason for that is the historical sanctuary, it goes all the way to the shore. I have no problem with that. But there are crabbers in Lynn Haven that do not have the same equal access as all the other crabbers, meaning you can go right out of your creek or whatever and go to work. So what I'm looking for is the same thing for a few crabbers down in Virginia Beach. This will alleviate the congestion inside Lynn Haven, possibly in Broad Bay, where there's always been a lot of conflict with different gear types. And that's pretty much what I'm looking for.
So I was looking at your description, Mark, and unfortunately I think some of that's going to run into the issue we've talked about previously with that Chesapeake Bay naval restricted area.
Here's the deal. You already have the comp potters, gill netters. There's all kinds of people that are working down there. The shrimpers also. That have been working there for years. We've worked there for years, never had a problem with it whatsoever. So we're going to allow one user group or three or four different user groups to go in an area where a crab potter can't. You know, gill net there, I mean, we do everything. Everything is done there except crab potting. When crab potting was done there, there were never any issues whatsoever. And there's no issues off Little Creek. We were approached earlier this year, and Harbor Security came out, and we just wanted to know what we were doing. That's all they wanted. They said, okay, have a good day. So to me, there is no conflict, no gear conflict or anything. And historically, there's only a few people that have gone down there stalking, but it would certainly help us a lot by being able to go there. And you keep bringing it up. The commandant or whoever it is that's in charge of that area, as you say, you've got other user groups going there. So what's the difference?
I mean, the problem is it's law. In the Code of Virginia, it says is prohibited in that area.
So it specifically says crab potting is prohibited in that area.
Anchoring, trawling, crabbing, fishing, and dragging.
Is that like chicken necking or commercial?
When that law was written, was with those boundary lines you're showing?
I don't know that anything has changed. This is from a map that was created, I want to say, in 2018. It was before I began, but I brought it up because I know we were talking about this area earlier this year, or last year, year before.
Was that provided by the Navy, that particular
one? I do not know the origin of this map.
Yeah. And are you referring to the CFR, I think it's
334.320.
Did you read all the way through the whole CFR?
I believe last time this issue came up,
because
yes.
In the CFR off of Little Creek, I believe it's the same one,
that says that they cannot impede any fishing activity with that CFR that you're referring to. Yeah, I can pull it up. So I think maybe you're working on not reading completely through that CFR.
Well, it's something we can continue looking into.
But you're saying in the regulation that you said, it says no, what does it preclude?
In the top corner there, which I'm realizing is probably too small for you to read, that is a section of, that is a screenshot of code, Code of Virginia.
And would you read it again?
Yes, federal.
Okay.
I can't find it now, but it does not exclude fishing. If it's the same one as Little Creek. Now, there is a prohibited area off Little Creek, which is about 400 yards wide by a quarter mile long, and that's blocked out also. That's prohibited. But that is not.
So it's something we can look into the full CFR for the next meeting.
It's very important that we do this because, you know, you have user groups going in there. There's no issue. Comp potters are the same as scrap potters, basically.
All right. Can we look at that then?
CFR, you have that as a member of the you put it.
I'm sorry?
The CFR you're quoting, that is in the entirety.
Okay.
It doesn't have the provision that marks quoting.
Okay, so maybe it's a different one.
It would be a different CFR, probably a different area. Than
part of that, because when we had a meeting back in 2020, something like that with the Navy.
With the Little Creek, Fort Story?
Right. Yeah. They had added in there.
That's something that could be, we can work with staff, we can research this further, and maybe if we have that fall meeting, we can bring it back up to that point and bring up the whole thing.
I think it's worthwhile. I mean, you're basically shoving crabbers in an area that's already overpopulated. And we're beating that area to death, is what we're doing. We're basically taking everything out of it.
Well, but if that area remains off limits, there are still, you would still want further down Virginia Beach?
Because
that would be an option for you to ask for.
Look, I'm just looking for a place to get as close to Lynn Haven. I mean, mm-hmm. If you look at the map, I mean, you can pretty much get everywhere, you know, other than off Lynn Haven. Anything is better than nothing, but what I'm asking for is preferred. You go right to Cape Henry, you start right there and go around. I crabbed down there in 1989, never had a problem. I had people approach me one time. It was before light. It was a straight light in the water, and they asked me to leave. They had no problem with me whatsoever. They said, come back when the sun's up. I said, good enough. And I went down to the other end of my line of work. So there's not an issue with the government.
Ron, when I wanted to change the sanctuary, original sanctuary, you helped me a whole lot getting that change, the boundaries changed. So,
you know, going outside Virginia, going outside of the ocean, I would have no problem creating.
You were a big help to get me that
a narrow, some kind of narrow strip that allows
that's all we're asking for. You still have a lot of area that, you know, and you're talking two crabbers. And I can tell you the way the weather is. If we went down there with any amount of pots within the last month, they would be gone. They disappear.
Right. I mean, I can tell you that if the commission decided on socioeconomic equitability, whatever, that they wanted to allow a strip there, BIMS would not oppose it.
Do we need to make a motion? We were bringing it to a meeting later, or?
No, we've
okay.
Yeah, we've got on the agenda.
All right. If we can bring it up again, I'll try to find the CFR that I'm talking about. It's different.
Okay.
If you can also that.
Yeah, because I'm pretty sure if I look back at our emails from the last time this came up, I think it's all there. Just, you know, only seeing this area when we spoke Tuesday, I haven't had time to go back and look.
Okay.
All right. Well, is it, Mark, you... I appreciate you bringing it up, but are we any other comments for the good of the cause? We have a motion for adjournment?
Motion.
All in favor?
Aye.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. We didn't make sense.
If you could.